Welcome to NTD Evening News, our top story tonight. Former President Trump wrapping up day 8 of his criminal trial in New York. Iris Tao is in Manhattan with the latest in the court proceedings and how Trump is responding to President Biden's long-awaited pledge to debate. Pro-Palestinian protesters on the campus of George Washington University. Sam Wong spoke with some of the activists to hear what they have to say about the war in Gaza. That says Israeli forces line up tanks and armored vehicles along Gaza's southern border. Is the long-anticipated ground offensive in Rafah coming soon? Jason Perry reports. More weapons for Ukraine. The U.S. today announcing a new $6 billion aid package. What it includes and how it differs from the $1 billion package announced just 2 days ago. And Arizona indicts 11 alternate electors from the 2020 presidential election. An attorney representing one of the electors joins us to break down the case.
This is NTD Evening News. Live from our NTD global headquarters in New York City, here is Tiffany Meyer.
Good evening and thank you for joining us tonight. Former President Trump finishing the second week of his criminal trial in New York. That says President Biden makes a striking shift by now pledging to debate Trump. NTD's White House correspondent Iris Tao has more from the Manhattan courthouse.
And President Biden, who for months has been declining to commit to a debate with Trump, today said he's happy to do it. Trump, on his way out of the courtroom in New York, responded to Biden this way.
We're willing to do it Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, or Friday night on national television. We're ready. Just tell me where. We'll do it at the White House. That would be very comfortable, actually. Oil prices are going up. You have the college campuses all over closed down. Our country is going to hell.
And that was Trump going straight into the campaign mode, despite being stuck at the courthouse. And during day 8 of the trial, we saw two new witnesses, one being a longtime assistant to Trump, and the other was a former banker to former Trump attorney Michael Cohen, who was allegedly involved in the alleged hush money payments. The most crucial witness so far, though, was David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer. And Pecker spent days testifying about an alleged scheme to buy and then bury negative stories to avoid harm to Trump's 2016 campaign. But Trump's lawyers, when questioning Pecker, try to show that Trump was not directly involved in buying stories and that it's standard practice for the publishers to do that, as Pecker's been doing for other celebrities. And Trump, on his way out of the courthouse, again insisting there's no crime.
Can't believe this is happening in our country. There's no case here. There's no case whatsoever. It's a disgrace. We have a conflicted judge and it shouldn't be happening. Not in this country. Thank you very much.
And next week, the judge could decide on Trump's alleged gag order violations. The trial will resume on next Tuesday. And next Wednesday, the day when Trump is not required to be in court, he will be back campaigning in Michigan and Wisconsin. Reporting from New York City, Iris Tao, NTD News.
Turning now to the pro-Palestine demonstrations sweeping the country, with anti-Israel sentiment now on the rise. Students and activists gathering at George Washington University to make their voices heard. NTD's Sam Wong has the story.
Free Palestine! Pro-Palestine sentiment is running high on the campus of George Washington University. Behind the barricades, students have been camping out on school grounds since Thursday morning. Waving flags and chanting slogans, demonstrators appear to be undeterred by the heavy security presence in the surrounding areas. Activists and organizers are demanding that the university divest from companies tied to Israel because of the war in Gaza. Protesters are also asking authorities to drop all charges against pro-Palestinian students who were arrested.
This isn't going to end with peace until the Israeli officials, the U.S. officials, are prosecuted for being complicit in war crimes and genocide.
Killing Palestinians in the name of a Jewish state doesn't make anyone safe, and we have no business doing it.
The university said the demonstrators had to clear out of the encampment by 7 p.m. Thursday. But up to this moment, the outrage carries on. Some fear the ongoing protests could trigger anti-Semitism on college campuses.
What they're doing is, you know, they're just doing at the bidding of Hamas. You can't let Hamas continue what they're doing. There won't be peace as long as Hamas is there.
To The demonstrators were also joined by students and professors from other schools, including Georgetown, American, and George Mason Universities, and the University of Maryland. Meanwhile, anti-Israel sentiment is picking up at schools across the country. It began with Columbia University in New York. Now at least 40 pro-Palestine camps have been established on different college campuses, from Boston to Atlanta to LA. And scuffles broke out this morning at the University of Southern California as police stepped in to disperse the crowd. As chaos unfolds, USC has announced it's canceling its main graduation ceremony. Back in New York City, Columbia University set a 48-hour deadline on Wednesday for students to clear out. Now that the deadline has passed, the campus's main lawn remains occupied as anti-Israel agitators refuse to back down. There has been a total of more than 500 arrests across American college campuses so far. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Sam Wong, NTD News.
Democrat Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman both visited the Columbia University encampments today. The two New York lawmakers are among the most progressive in Congress. And the latest in the Israel-Hamas war, some residents in the Gaza Strip are moving away from Rafah City ahead of an expected IDF invasion. But where will they go to find safety? NTD's Jason Perry has the war update.
On Friday, Israeli tanks and armored vehicles were seen lined up along Gaza's southern border. It appears that Israel is now preparing to start the long-anticipated ground offensive in the crowded city of Rafah. Israel says Rafah is one of the final strongholds of Hamas terrorists. But leaders around the world, including those in the U.S., have urged Israel not to conduct a ground offensive in the southern Gaza city due to the risk of civilian casualties.
And we've had very detailed discussions with the Israelis as recently as last week by secure video to talk through not just our concerns, but our view that there is a different way to go about dealing with the Hamas threat in Rafah. And succeeding in ensuring the long-term defense and security of Israel.
And on the other side of the border, Gaza residents who were displaced to Rafah now find themselves moving again.
They said there will be a military offensive in Rafah. That's the news we're hearing. There will be shelling on Rafah. So we said, let's take ourselves and move to Deir al-Balah, where it will be safe.
We left Rafah due to a fear of a ground operation. We came to Deir al-Balah hoping and praying it would be safe, but there is no safe place.
Deir al-Balah is located in the central Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, across Israel's northern border, the Iran-backed Hezbollah terrorist group in Lebanon released a video of an attack on an Israeli convoy, claiming to destroy two vehicles on Thursday. The Israeli military said the attack injured one Israeli civilian who later died from his injuries. Some Israeli residents shared their thoughts about the constant threat from Hezbollah terrorists.
There's going to be a war in a year, in 2 years, there's going to be something with Hezbollah. So I think we should end it now and not wait.
I don't know if war is the only solution, but if it is, then yeah, if that's what needs to be done, then that's what needs to be done.
Also on Friday, Israeli troops removed the remains of an Iranian missile that was intercepted during the recent attack from Tehran. The IDF warned civilians not to touch any missile debris and asked them to report their findings to the Israeli police. Jason Perry, NTD News.
A new $6 billion aid package for Ukraine. Today, the U.S. announced it will help replenish Ukraine's air defense systems. This comes just days after President Biden announced a $1 billion aid package.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ukraine's struggle for freedom matters to us all.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on Friday announced a new $6 billion aid package for Ukraine. The main objective is to provide Ukraine with additional Patriot missiles for its air defense systems. The package also includes more munitions for the National Advanced Surface-to-Air Missile Systems, as well as additional gear to integrate Western air defense launchers, missiles, and radars.
Together, we'll continue to work on two tracks. rushing Ukraine the capabilities to meet its urgent battlefield needs, and helping Ukraine to build the future force to stave off and deter Russian aggression over the longer term.
But Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky was seeking more than just missiles. This morning, before the U.S. announced the new package, Zelensky advocated for new Patriot systems.
We urgently need Patriot systems and missiles for them. This is what can and should save lives right now.
Austin said he'll ask allies to send additional Patriot systems, but he didn't commit to sending more U.S. ones. Friday's package comes just days after the Biden administration approved a $1 billion aid package. Those weapons also include air defense munitions, as well as large amounts of artillery rounds, armored vehicles, and more. Both packages are part of the $95 billion foreign aid bill, which President Biden signed this week. And in other Ukraine-related news, a Ukrainian court today ordered the country's agriculture minister to be taken into custody. He's allegedly been involved in an illegal purchase of state-owned land. The land is worth about $7 million. The judge set bail at almost $2 million. The minister submitted his resignation yesterday, but he technically remains in his post until Parliament considers his request. He is the first known minister under President Zelensky to be named a suspect in a corruption case. Virginia Gibson, NTD News.
Coming up, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is wrapping up his trip to China. This as the U.S. stands against the Chinese regime on many issues. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley breaks it down from the State Department. In Arizona, 18 people are expecting to be arraigned after the state's attorney general accused them of attempting to overturn the results of 2020 presidential election in that state. Arlene Richards breaks down what's in the charging documents when we come back. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Chinese regime leader Xi Jinping in Beijing today, wrapping up a three-day visit to China. NTD's Jack Bradley has more from the State Department.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken raised many issues on his visit to China, including concerns over the Chinese Communist Party supplying Russia with weapons that it uses to fight Ukraine. Blinken also met with his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi, who has accused the U.S. of overplaying its concerns that China's manufacturing overcapacity is flooding global markets. But Blinken reaffirmed these claims.
That allows those products then to be sold at low prices and sometimes below market prices in other countries, pushing businesses from those countries out of business and having potentially devastating effects on communities, on workers, on businesses. That's something that we have to, will, and are standing against.
The State Department says the two sides also talked about Taiwan and the South China Sea. This comes as the U.S. just this week approved over $8 billion to help Taiwan defend against the Chinese Communist Party's actions in the Indo-Pacific. Blinken said he discussed cracking down on fentanyl with Chinese officials. The majority of the fentanyl in the United States originates in China. A report this month by the House Select Committee on the CCP found that the Chinese regime subsidizes and provides grants to companies that produce and export fentanyl chemicals. While in Beijing, Blinken has said that the Chinese regime has been working to interfere and influence the U.S. 2024 election.
We have seen, generally speaking, evidence of attempts to influence and arguably interfere, and we want to make sure that that's cut off as quickly as possible.
This comes as President Biden signed a bill this week that forces TikTok to cut its ties with its Chinese owner, ByteDance, or be banned in U.S. app stores. Now, this comes amid concerns over data privacy that the Chinese regime can access user data on anyone in America that uses TikTok. But Blinken said TikTok did not come up in the discussions with Chinese officials. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
Turning now to the nine-count Arizona election indictment, 18 people on Wednesday were accused of attempting to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. Our legal correspondent Arlene Richards takes a closer look and breaks down the details.
Arizona's election was free and fair.
Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays unleashed a 58-page indictment on Wednesday that charges 18 people with conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. The accused are 11 Republicans and 7 former Trump advisors. Those advisors include former Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani. All of the charges are Class 2 to Class 5 felonies under Arizona law. 11 defendants are charged with scheming to prevent the transfer of the presidency from Trump to President Biden. According to the indictment, they falsely claimed election fraud to pressure Arizona election officials to change the results. And when that failed, those 11 defendants falsely claimed to be duly elected and qualified electors for Trump, intending to encourage then-Vice President Mike Pence to reject the Biden-Harris votes on January 6, 2021. Some of the defendants have previously stated that they signed on as electors to serve as a backup slate. Their votes would only count if litigation or other action showed that Trump actually won the race. But the indictment rejects that claim and accuses them of deceiving Arizona voters. The former Trump advisors, including attorneys and 2020 campaign staff, are accused of spreading false claims against Arizona election officials and carrying out the scheme to submit so-called fake electors. They are also accused of pressuring state officials to change the votes. Trump is identified as one of the 5 unindicted co-conspirators, which include former members of the Arizona legislature. Defendant Anthony Kern, who is an Arizona state senator, in responding to the indictment said, "When President Trump called for my aid, I answered. My reward? A crooked Democrat attorney general prosecuting me with 9 fabricated felonies. Next steps? Each defendant will negotiate a date to surrender for booking, get photographed and fingerprinted, and attend a hearing before a judge, where they will most likely plead not guilty." Arlene Richards, NTD News.
To better understand the case in Arizona, earlier we spoke with Mike Colombo, partner at Dillon Law Group. He's an attorney representing one of the alternate electors indicted in this case, Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman. Mike Colombo, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, to begin, break down this case for us. Help us understand what's happening here.
So, as you and your listeners know, in the wake of the 2020 election, many people, millions of people, had concerns about how the election was conducted. Unfortunately, the law only allows a small window of time for a presidential election for any errors to be corrected. Ultimately, people took their concerns. They filed lawsuits. They went to their government officials. But those processes did not have an opportunity to reach their conclusion. Unfortunately, by December 14th, or on December 14th of 2020, the electors in any given state have to identify themselves and cast their votes as electors. And what I'm talking about here is not the vote in the election of voters like you and me. What we're talking about is in the American election system, once a person or candidate wins a state's election, they are assigned a certain number of electors who then get to vote as part of the Electoral College vote. And that's that magic number of 270 that you hear of in the news. So for Arizona, for example, as well as every other state, the people who represent the winning candidate are supposed to meet and vote and certify their identity on December 14th, in this case, 2020. The problem arises where there's some concern over the outcome of the election. Because if these court cases or other procedures were to result in a different outcome for the election, and the new winner of the election did not have their electors certified on December 14th, there could be a question as to whether or not there really was anything that the government could do to fix the election. Unfortunately, the law and the precedent here is not abundantly clear, or at least it wasn't in December of 2020. There was a prior example in 1960 in the contest between Nixon and Kennedy in Hawaii, where as the date for certification or for the electors to be identified came around, there was still an ongoing recount. In that case, both candidates had their electors meet. And as it turned out, at a later time, it was determined that the person they thought was the winner actually didn't win. And so the alternate electors in 1960 in Hawaii became the actual electors. So when we get to 2020, even liberal commentators like Lessig and Jones on CNN opined that Biden should have an alternate slate of electors in Pennsylvania. So, you know, that's the situation people were in. There's a lot of concerns about what happened in the election. People had filed lawsuits. People were going to their government officials to see if they could do something about it. And on December 14th, the indictment alleges that a group of people in Arizona, as well as other places, met and identified themselves as President Trump's electors. The indictment claims that by doing this, they committed various crimes.
Now, numerous Republicans and conservatives have come out calling this a political prosecution. Is that your view? And if so, what would lead you to believe that?
So, yeah, I think people will reach their own conclusions. It is certainly a concern that people have expressed. I think to get to the reasons why they have those concerns, you know, your viewers can draw their own conclusions. We are talking about activity that occurred 3.5 years ago. At the time that the electors, the defendants in this case, met in Arizona on December 14th, they took pictures of what they were doing. They took video of what they were doing. They shared this on social media. One of them even wrote a book about it. There was nothing in the way that they acted that indicated that they thought they were doing anything wrong. But in any event, what they did was there for all the world to see. As I mentioned, commentators on TV had already been talking about the use of alternate electors. Let's flash forward to 2022. You have an enormous investigation by the January 6th Select Committee that interviewed, I think, over 1,000 witnesses and millions of pages of documents, and they come out with a very comprehensive report about what happened. And mind you, that's nearly 2 years ago. So here we are in 2024. Why is this indictment being dropped in 2024, just shortly before Arizona's elections begin? We have a primary coming up in Arizona and then the 2024 general election. So the timing of it is extremely suspicious. As you know, other cases that other allegations were made a long time ago. You've got the federal prosecution by Jack Smith, and you've got a case in Georgia as well as Michigan. So why is Arizona's indictment coming now? To add to that concern, the fact is the indictment is being brought by Democrat Attorney General Chris Mayes. She is on record at Democrat Attorney General's Association meeting saying that she felt that it is her job to get Biden elected. This is just fueling more concern that her actions are partisan. And unfortunately, we had the spectacle just recently of the targets of the grand jury being paraded in front of the jury to invoke their Fifth Amendment right. It's highly unusual. It's extremely uncommon. In some places, it might even be considered professionally unethical to have someone who said that they're going to claim the Fifth Amendment right to be put in front of the jury. So all of this put together has really generated a lot of concerns and questions about whether this is a political prosecution.
And what is next in this case then?
So the indictment has just come down. I believe they're in the process of, you know, formally serving the indictment on the various people who have been indicted. They're going to be given a date to come in and be processed, you know, have their pictures taken, their fingerprints taken. That process will probably play out over the next month or so. Meanwhile, the defense teams, like ours, will be evaluating their legal options to see what they can do to challenge the indictment and formulating their defense strategies.
Mike Colombo, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, former President Trump wraps up the second week of his so-called hush money trial in New York. Jesse Bernal, an attorney for Trump in his civil cases, reacts to the proceedings. And what do lawmakers think of the rift among House Republicans? One says it's important not to create chaos during an election year, but others say policy is even more important. Luis Martinez reports from CPAC in Hungary. That and more when we return. Welcome back. If you're just joining us now, here are some of today's top headlines. Anti-Israel encampments have spread to dozens of college campuses across the nation, from Boston to Atlanta to L.A. Columbia University's main lawn remains occupied as the deadline for negotiations passed. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up his three-day visit to China. He discussed a range of issues with top Chinese officials, from trade to fentanyl to Taiwan and Ukraine. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced a new $6 billion aid package for Ukraine that includes air defense missiles and munitions. This came as Ukraine's agriculture minister resigned over allegations of corruption. President Biden said for the first time that he is willing to debate former President Trump. This came as Trump appeared in court for day 8 of his New York hush money trial. Earlier, we spoke with Jesse Bernal, attorney for Trump in his civil cases, to get his reactions to Trump's hush money case in New York and the presidential immunity case before the Supreme Court. Jesse Bernal, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Now, in former President Trump's hush money criminal trial in New York, the defense team wrapped up cross-examination of David Pecker. Now, Pecker struck a pretty defiant tone today, saying, quote, "I've been truthful." What do you make of his testimony?
Well, I mean, we'll see how his testimony plays with the jury, but I think there's a few important things to take away from this, and that is that, again, much of this of the government's case actually relies on the word of Michael Cohen. And he admitted that there were conversations that President Trump wasn't a part of. He admitted that there is very possibly information that Michael Cohen could have been doing behind his back with Kerry McDougal's lawyer, for instance. And so I think it's very important to see that the president's lawyers in this case, who are, by the way, excellent trial lawyers, are whittling away at the factual part of the government's case, which really is built on a house of cards. But the important thing also to remember here is, even if everything the government says is true, there's no crime here. There's never been any crime here. You have federal election commissioners, people who actually have served on the body that oversees campaign finance law, that have said there's absolutely no legal basis to say that this is a violation of campaign finance law, which is the entire basis of Alvin Bragg's case here. And so as the facts continue to get whittled away and the government's case continues to start to fall apart, the important thing I think we all should remember is there was no legal basis to bring this case in the first place. This case isn't about justice. It's all about trying to interfere with the 2024 presidential election.
Trump is the presumptive GOP nominee and has been calling this trial election interference. He has managed to squeeze a few campaign stops in before and after court. But how do you see these proceedings impacting him in his campaign?
Well, I mean, it's certainly going to impact. It's a real problem when you give a state judge, a Democrat state judge, power over the schedule of the Republican nominee for president of the United States, which is exactly what's going on right now. And so this is, you know, just for the future of American democracy, this is a very, very real problem and why we need to have some accountability at some point. Because, yes, there is this impact where, like I said, it's more than any case I think we've ever seen before. This is the process being itself being the punishment. And so yes, there is an impact that this judge has been able to have. President Trump has been able to still have rallies. He on weekends, and yes, he has been going out after court and talking to American voters in New York. But it's not the way that it should be. It's not the way our system was meant to work, where both candidates are free to go out and talk to the voters of their choice in the locations of their choice. And so it's a very, very real problem. And the one thing I think we know from this is that after this is all over, there has to be accountability. What we are seeing right now is the violation of civil rights under color of law and a conspiracy to violate civil rights. That is illegal. That is a federal offense. And what I very much hope happens is that we put a permanent stop to this type of lawfare by prosecuting the prosecutors and even the judges who have engaged in these violations of civil rights under color of law after President Trump wins.
Now, this week, the Supreme Court took up the case of whether or not a former president has absolute immunity. Trump today saying his team's arguments were brilliant and that the judge's questions were really great. What is your read on how SCOTUS is leaning?
Well, I got to be there yesterday, and the president's absolutely right. His counsel was absolutely brilliant in the argument and was really able to help the justices synthesize what is at issue. And what was at issue here is whether or not prosecutors, unelected prosecutors, can be able to assert their authority over a president by effectively being able to threaten to prosecute him once he leaves office. That is not going to just affect former presidents, it's going to affect current presidents. Because the president is going to know if he runs afoul of these bureaucrats in the Department of Justice, if he makes them mad, then he could end up having to go to jail after his term of office is over, because while a president's there for 4 or 8 years, unfortunately, these bureaucratic prosecutors are there for their entire career. They will outlast pretty much every president. And so that's why it's so important, and that's why I think the justices were very, very concerned with this issue. I think the one thing that is probably not going to happen is they're not going to simply agree with the D.C. Circuit that said there's no such thing as criminal immunity at all. In fact, Jack Smith's team really even backed away from the decision of the D.C. Circuit because they had to, because it just didn't logically hold together. And when they basically said you can prosecute, as Chief Justice Roberts said yesterday, the position of the D.C. Circuit was you can prosecute the president because he's being prosecuted. It is not enough when you're talking about a president. There's always going to, at the very least, be core functions of the presidency where when the president does that, it places him beyond the reach of prosecution for those official acts. And so we'll see what the Supreme Court actually does. And, you know, I think it's very telling that there's so many commentators on the left who are, you know, urging the Supreme Court to act with reckless abandon and just go and make a decision quickly, when in reality, this is a very, very important case for our functioning constitutional republic. And that if that constitutional republic is to continue to work, continue to serve the American people, the justices are going to have to come out with a very good, strong opinion here, and that might take a little bit of time, and that's fine. It's what we expect from them, for them to do their constitutional duty, not participate with Jack Smith in his rush to try to railroad Donald Trump before the election in November, which he's all but admitted he's doing.
Jesse Banal, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Congress is in recess today, and our correspondent Luis Martinez caught up with several U.S. representatives while attending a political action conference in Budapest, Hungary. They discussed the future of the House Republican Conference and its leadership.
While Congress is in recess, a threat hangs over Speaker Johnson's head. Over a month ago, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to vacate the speakership after Speaker Johnson relied on Democrats in order to legislate. Since then, Speaker Johnson has passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and also foreign aid to Israel, Taiwan, and Ukraine with the help of Democrats. According to Speaker Johnson, that's because he has a razor-thin majority of one congressman. I had the opportunity today to speak with Congressman Keith Self, the Republican from Texas, and he had a different view on the speaker's strategy. Let's listen.
No, it's not an excuse at all. We need to continue to stand for conservative principles. We need to act on them. We need to get people on the record for voting for conservative principles or against conservative principles. And I'm talking about Republicans voting for or against Republican conservative principles.
To showcase the differences among House Republicans and even among conservatives, I had the opportunity to speak with Congressman Andy Harris, the Republican from Maryland, and he had a different view than Congressman Keith Self on the speaker's strategy. Let's listen.
You know, we're getting into the middle of an election year, and to be honest, Congress usually doesn't do too much after the middle of an election year. So I don't think creating chaos at this point in time is a good idea. I think we can have this discussion after the elections if we want to.
I also had the opportunity to speak with former U.S. Senator Rick Santorum, and he had no appreciation for politicians in office who do not govern according to the policies that they campaigned on.
The people who go out there and say that are just doing it to promote themselves. They're not being helpful. They're not being truthful to conservatives. The idea that a one-seat majority in the House of Representatives against the president of the other party, against the Senate of the other party, and against a media that is fundamentally against you, that somehow or another you should control Washington is a fallacy.
Despite the clear differences among House Republicans, both congressmen I spoke with today do not expect to see any major legislation pass the House of Representatives until at least after the general elections in November. Reporting from Budapest, Hungary, Luis Eduardo Martinez, NTD News.
Has the world forgotten October 7th, Israel's 9/11? Kelly Wright traveled to Israel to speak to survivors and hostages' family members. They vow never to forget as they combat anti-Semitism and fight for freedom. Watch Hope for Israel at NTD News primetime special tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern here on NTD. Coming up, a historic pier in Southern California catches on fire. It's mostly contained after crews battled the blaze for an entire night. Jason Blair reports. And in NBA news, could LeBron James and company be swept out of the playoffs again? Dave Martin joins us to discuss the Lakers series. That's coming up. Welcome back. I'm Tiffany Meyer. A large fire broke out at a historic pier in Southern California. The blaze is finally under control after first responders worked through the night to contain it. NTD's Jason Blair reports.
Officials said the fire started around 3 p.m. Thursday in Oceanside, California. Heavy smoke was seen coming from a vacant restaurant at the end of the pier. Firefighters battled the blaze on foot using boats as well as helicopters. Oceanside Fire Chief David Parsons said 90% of the pier is intact. Most of the damage has been done to the vacant buildings at the end of the pier. No injuries have been reported. The city said that the blaze has been contained to the far west end of the pier as of 7 o'clock Friday morning. The pier has since been closed. The beach is also closed until further notice because of chemicals and other possibly hazardous materials getting into the ocean due to the fire. According to the city, Oceanside Pier was first built in 1888. Since then, it's been reconstructed several times. It's the longest wooden pier on the West Coast at 1,954 feet. It's popular among both tourists and locals. The city said a cause is expected to be determined within a few days. Jason Blair, NTD News.
Staying on the West Coast, after a string of violent attacks on the Los Angeles Metro Transit, one county member now fears taking the transportation herself. NTD's Christina Corona has the details.
An LA Metro board member expressed fear, stating she wouldn't ride the city's transit alone. The remarks come after a board meeting when the board of directors declared a public safety emergency. Board Member Catherine Barger, a member of the LA County Board of Supervisors, said in Thursday's meeting, "I will not ride our transit system by myself. I am afraid and I sit on Metro, but I will not ride it." This comes after a string of violent attacks this month, resulting in multiple victims hospitalized and one woman dead in Studio City on Monday.
Tragic and heinous slaying of Myrna Souza by an individual who had previously attacked a passenger on a Metro train in Los Angeles and was ordered to stay away from Metro trains for 3 years.
The suspect, 45-year-old transient Elliot Noden, stabbed Souza in the throat with a pair of kitchen knives. He has been charged with murder and could face life in prison upon conviction. Earlier this month, a bus driver was stabbed by a passenger in Willowbrook, while another man was stabbed in the Silver Lake neighborhood on the same day in unrelated incidents. We spoke with a Metro rider who shared his thoughts on the recent crimes.
It's not really something you could really exactly prepare for unless you just stay to yourself, stay out the way, and try to avoid people who you feel like might have bad intentions. And it's kind of unpredictable. Anybody who's doing a stabbing like that is not in their right mind.
LA Metro officials authorized emergency approval to provide its 2,000 Metro buses with shatterproof glass barriers around transit drivers. Assaults on bus operators have increased from 92 in 2019 to 160 in 2023, and attacks have continued this year. The board said they are looking into the possibility of banning problematic individuals from Metro altogether. Christina Corona, NTD News, El Monte.
And now for your sports news, we're joined by NTD's Dave Martin. Dave, plenty to discuss, but let's start in football, where the first round of the NFL draft took place last night. Now, it seems like this was a quarterback-heavy draft. Was that expected?
Yeah, but maybe not like this. I think most people thought the first three picks would probably be quarterbacks for sure, but then maybe a couple after that. It was a little surprising then when Bo Nix was taken at number 12. He was a sixth quarterback taken. That's the most ever through 12 picks. Probably the biggest surprise was Atlanta taking quarterback Michael Penix Jr. with their first pick, given that they just signed quarterback Kirk Cousins to a $180 million contract last month. After all, you usually don't draft a quarterback with your first pick, just let him watch from the bench for the next few years. But you don't sign someone to a $180 million contract and sit them on the bench either. So they have to figure out, you know, which direction they're going with this. In any case, their draft continues tonight with rounds 2 and 3, and then concludes tomorrow with rounds 4 through 7.
Looking at the NHL playoffs, there are 4 games on tonight, including a Rangers-Capitals game 3. Now, the Rangers lead this series 2-0. How have they been able to stay ahead?
Well, partly because they've limited Washington's Alex Ovechkin to just one shot on goal through 2 games. He has no goals at all in these 2 games so far. Now, he may be getting up there in years. He's now 38 years old, but he was a Caps leading goal scorer again this season. And the Rangers, you know, they had the best record in the league this year, so they know how to do this. Now, tonight, we also have 3 Game 3s, all in series that are tied at 1 game apiece. That's Vancouver, Nashville, Winnipeg, Colorado, and Edmonton versus LA. Now, I'm especially interested to see this last series. I mean, not only is this the third straight time Edmonton's faced LA in the first round, it seems like Edmonton has the talent to win it all. I mean, they've got a lot of talent around Connor McDavid. He's generally regarded as the best player in the game. So maybe this is finally their year.
Shifting gears to the NBA playoffs, the Nuggets beat the Lakers again last night to take a 3-0 series lead. Did you foresee this series going this way?
No, I mean, I thought the Nuggets would win the series, but I thought the Lakers would at least take a few games and make this one close. I mean, Denver swept them last year, and they've now beat them 11 straight times overall, which is very tough to do against a good team. Now, they're not blowing them out either. I mean, last night, the Nuggets won by 7. They won the previous game on a last-second buzzer-beating shot, so it's not total domination. Now, Grant, the Nuggets are the defending champions. They have the best player in the game in Nikola Jokic. He's a near impossible matchup. But the Lakers, they have Anthony Davis and LeBron James. They won the title 4 years ago with those two leading the way. Now, this is a best of 7 series, so the Lakers are technically still alive, but they would have to come back from an 0-3 deficit to win this series. No one has ever done that in the history of the NBA playoffs.
Looking at tonight's NBA action, you've previously highlighted the Phoenix Suns spending a lot of money for a possible first-round exit. What do they need to do to get back into this series?
Well, for one thing, they need to get Devin Booker going. He's been quite the playoff performer in the past. He's been shut down in the two games thus far, averaging just 19 points a game. I mean, his career playoff average is 27. Now, the Suns made some major offseason moves last summer in trading Chris Paul for Bradley Beal. They got younger with that move, but Beal also has a much bigger contract, and I thought they needed to bring in more of a distributor to replace Paul. In any case, that series heads to tonight, heads to Phoenix tonight for Game 3. We also have a Game 3 tonight between the Clips and Mavs in a series tied at 1. Ditto for the Bucks and Pacers, but Milwaukee will still be without two-time MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo. He's been out since April 9 with a calf strain, so plenty of NBA action tonight as well.
Well, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tiff.
And that's all for today's news. For round-the-clock coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Good night.